We go. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Chris Robet.
And Chris, it is really lovely to see you after many years. I was trying to work out how many, but I'm thinking it could be in the teens in terms of years, probably. But, I followed your work all that time, and there's been a veritable incarnation of new Robet work during those years, and really important. So I'd like to start, although we'll move on to talking about that work, by asking you what's currently going on for you that is holding you back, or dynamizing you, or preoccupying you, or interesting you. What's going on right now?
Thanks, Toby, first of all, for inviting me to the podcast. It's a real honor, and I love listening to it. For me, living in the state of Florida, as you might imagine, reactionary populism and its various incarnations and the ways in which it impacts all of us has been on my mind, both at a very personal level and also in kind of a research level. On the personal level, I have always been fairly involved with my faculty union and just sort of dealing with the brunt of bad legislation and microaggressions and the ways in which this awful slate of stuff from DeSantis and other politicians is coming down of trying to bridge or if not eliminate academic freedom, tenure, so on and so forth. I am so thankful we actually have a union here in some ways, because I think we would be totally way more devastated than we are, because there's been a complete failure of leadership, right, in the state of Florida by the university presidents and provosts to get together and defend what should be core principles of the university. Nor you will not hear hide nor hair of them speaking in a public forum about this stuff. They'll assure you that they're doing things behind the scenes, but as we can see, that only goes so far and is deeply problematic when you cede the public sphere, right, from what you're doing. So we're kind of trying to rethink here, in Florida in general, as faculty, to not only how to ward off some of the worst aspects of what has been happening here, but I'm an organizer at heart. So how do you use this crisis and mobilize right upon it as an opportunity? And how do we get faculty? They are, believe it or not, fired up. They don't know where to channel their energy. So it's been a lot of my work in terms of doing that. I won't go into the specifics in some ways, just because I want to kind of keep that between me and them who I'm working with.
Well,
But I think there is
Ron DeSantis is a key sponsor of the podcast, as you can imagine.
a
Ronnie and I, we're really like this, shows fingers overlapping. And I don't want to lose his implicit sponsorship. There are occasional product placements of Ronnie, but they've diminished since the presidential campaign hit the inevitable wall of a superior intellect running away with the Republican nomination. Anyway, sorry. I take your point. Don't give away the secrets of the trade, dude.
You can eliminate this part of the podcast to be talking smack about our local politicians. So on one level, it's been a challenge, but it's also been invigorating, because we have to reconceptualize the ways in which the union and solidarity have been operating in a new way, right? We're just forced to operate in a new direction. And I'm very influenced by Gramsci and British cultural studies and stuff. So I find that's the theorization of this stuff very useful. And then sort of an intellectual level too, because of this sort of right turn, this reactionary populist turn, and I'm looking in the belly of the beast, I was starting to turn research towards that direction of looking at sort of conservative media activism. And so for the last couple of years, I've been, I don't know if you want to say infiltrating, but definitely going to moderate to extreme right-wing gatherings here in South Florida, just to get a sense of what's going on, the feeling of it, what's being discussed, so on and so forth. And I didn't really want to write about that, but I just wanted to have a sense of what was going on, because there's a really intimate way you could hear, and I have the perfect costume to do it. I'm white, middle class, right, cisgendered, male. They don't ask you anything when you go there, right, looking like I do. So I thought it's fairly decent to go there. And so I've been thinking about what I would actually write about. And particularly, I've been brewing in my mind is that film, The Sound of Freedom, that came out this summer, past summer. That's been a big hit, right? And it was really frustrating hearing about the film and how it's been kind of analyzed as sort of just dismissed as a QAnon fantasy, or these, dummies who go see the film and sort of just get enraptured. I went to see, and it's massively effective in terms of what's going on. And I just thought, yeah, we have to look at how that film is mobilizing upon Hollywood and its racial capitalism and its settler colonialism. I have a read that that film, everybody reads that film like Hollywood didn't want to do it because, it's just offensive to Hollywood. I would actually say the reason probably studios didn't want to do the film is it revealed Hollywood actually in being in alignment with what that film does. It happens to be child abduction, sex trafficking, right? That does play into conservative discourse. But hey, Avatar does a very similar thing in terms of what's going on of yet another white person saving people who are purple itself. So I think we really have to reckon with, the underlying premises and just foundations of white supremacy, racial capitalism, so on and so forth across our culture that these sort of conservative media can mobilize upon because it is the bedrock in many ways of the foundations of the United States. And until we come to like address that, we're going to keep misreading this and marginalizing things in ways that are unproductive, right? And not really grappling with what the right's doing well. I'll just say, as a side note here, one big influence of Stuart Hall on me, and I think one of the most underanalyzed books ever, is The Hard Road to Renewal, right? Where he's really addressing Thatcherism and getting on the left for dismissing it and saying, this is just a bunch of yahoos. We got to keep doing what we're doing, right? He starts asking the question, what is the right doing correctly that we're not doing, right? How is it mobilizing in a populism that we are seen to be foreign with? And I think we're at that juncture right now, that we need to do that again.
Chris, I'm reminded of two things. First of all, the old Tom Lehrer song with reference to the Spanish Civil War, particularly poignant for me because I'm living in Spain now. And, they may have won all the battles, but we had all the good songs, is one of the lines in it. And the other thing it makes me think of is a new report this week by BBC Mundo, the BBC Spanish language service, about Javier Milei. And Javier Milei, the incredibly awful new president of Argentina, has identified Gramsci as a key to trying to unlock the cultural successes of the left in Argentina, and goes on and on and on about it. And in fact, in Latin America, as you know, people on the right as well as the left have used the idea of a national popular for a long time. So where this is dragging me is to ask you this. There's a shift from that moment when you could say with Tom Lehrer, we've always had the great poets, the great artists, the great musicians. We keep losing to these bastards in lots of areas. When people say the 60s were a failure in the United States, I don't think so at all. The 60s were a Gramscian triumph because the left went into not only organizing about personal transformation, but also libraries, schools, universities, publishing, art, you name it, right? Forget Hollywood, which was never really more than liberal, apart from the stuff that you've excavated so brilliantly from an earlier period. But all these other areas we did take on and take over in lots of ways. So my question for you is that I worry that the right has learnt from our, if I can term it that, use of the politics of spectacle and is almost transcending it. So when you and I were young and not so young, activist meant feminist, anti-colonial, etc. Now, does activist mean something else?
Yeah, it's a strange moment of reconciling those, dimensions in that. I think for sure the right has mobilized upon tactics that we have historically used and are currently doing them better, right, over some media. I will say on one level that gives me some hope is like on the broad cultural terrain, right? It does seem the left and progressives have won in like watching cinema. Hearing this and that, it's pervasive in some ways. When you talk to your students, right, and how they dialogue with you, for all our Atlantic University where I'm at, I feel really lucky. It's a lot of first generation college students, and it's very affordable university, so it actually is diverse, right? In a substantive way that I've never witnessed before. We have Latin American students, Caribbean students, working class students that predominate in the classrooms and the sense of diversity. And you talk to them, right? You're getting various different perspectives, but nonetheless, they seem to be in alignment, right? We're not indoctrinating. They're coming to us, right? Wanting a more diverse world, wanting, right, experimenting in these various ways. And I feel Florida's a good example of when you have to legislate this stuff of anti-LGBTQ, anti-CL, critical race theory. It actually shows the failure on their part because they don't have the cultural terrain. So they're trying to use, right, this legislation to actually impose upon us itself. It reveals a actually fundamental weakness to me, and an insecurity, which of course backfires on them because students love rebelling against, any kind of authoritarian paternalistic thing. With that said, Toby, I'm always grappling with this too myself of how do we translate sort of that cultural power in political directions in ways that we don't sort of look at more political economy stuff like. So yes, okay, the content in the humanities in many ways could be progressive, right? Considered progressive and has gotten better. But the actual political economy of the university is awful. It's like the leader of a neoliberal mindset and exploitation going on. So there's a huge disconnect between what faculty individually do in their classrooms and the larger political economic system that is incredibly cruel to a majority of faculty staff. Who work at these institutions. So I feel like in some ways the work of cultural studies is sort of like, okay, how do we translate these things? Sort of going back to that Gramscian project, how do we mobilize on the cultural terrain into the political itself? I don't know exactly, right?
But no, point taken. And I think it's really significant that these people who, before October the 7th last year, went on and on and on about cancel culture, now want to stop people from speaking out on campus and elsewhere. But here's my provocation for you. January 6, 2021. Sedition, evil, anti-constitutional, da 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 da. If people dressed similarly had done that in the first week of January, 20 years earlier, when George W. Bush was being inaugurated or his election was being endorsed, what would have been our attitude? If there had been a storming of the Capitol by progressives and they'd sat on the speaker's chair, desk, and written stupid notes, you know what I mean? What would we have felt and thought and said?
Yeah, it's nearly inconceivable in the sense that, like, if anything, January 6th revealed the alignment of this reactionaryism with the state, right? That would have never been possible for BLM protesters or so to even get within that proximity and not be taken seriously. If anything, the left always deals with the complete opposite of the hyperbole of our threat, even when there is none, right? The anarchists are coming. They're going to come lob piss, and shit at you. Like all these things that you'll see in the playbook, the reactionary playbook to legitimize state repression and money's going in that way. Whereas we have the complete opposite of January 6th, where there seemed to be a very viable threat that was going through multiple social media networks, as we found out with the committee meetings afterwards. Yet there was a constant, right, just brushing it aside as this isn't serious. So I feel like it exposes a lot, right, January 6th in a way that others have pointed out as well.
No, I think that's true. And I remember when I joined NYU in the mid 90s, the only thing that I think I had to swear was that I would not engage in sedition. But getting back to the 30s and 40s, if we could, Prof, and your amazing work on that, and that moment when, even in the context of the Hollywood studios, there were really committed progressives in positions of some significance in acting, in screenwriting, in directing, and so on. And I wonder if you could, give us a little horizon tour, as it were, of your left of Hollywood work to give us something to grip onto that we can feel happy about right now, in amongst the horrors of DeSantis, and his crew. And Ron, I mean you no ill. I know you're listening. And I really love you with big uplifts in your shoes. They look terrific, dude.
I should give a shout out here, first of all. I don't know. I mean, first of all, people who were advising me at that time, Alexander Doty and this guy, Seth Moglin, who were really great and influential,
Wonderful.
as well as Michael Dennings' amazing book, right? The Cultural Front, which I think was a
Fantastic.
game changer for me. That really inspired, like, I think I was going to do something different. It came out of my dissertation originally, but it was just like I read that and thought there was more, meat there than there had been before. And
By the way, Chris Michael is a future victim of the podcast.
as he should be,
He's locked in.
as he should be. You can give him my reference for him, but yeah, and I felt like there was really scant work on film criticism and sort of film culture in the 30s at the time when I was working on it. There were two really great books, William Alexander and Russell Campbell, in the early 80s that did it. But when I started doing that work, it was 2000, like literally, 2000, 2001, and nothing was being done. So I just felt like there was, and if anything was mentioning the 30s, it's like, ah, it's a reductive age. There are a bunch of, just like vulgar Marxists and stuff, like very much the inheritances of the Cold War of disowning anything that came before it as irrelevant, struck me as relevant. And I'll also give one more shout out to Stephen J. Ross, who's a great historian of labor cinema. And I love that, I think it's called Working Class Cinema, the book he did, but it was the appendix that was a game changer, where he referenced the Museum of Modern Art, where there's this 30s archive that I went into and delved in. It was thanks to that,
Beautiful.
yeah, that thing. And I was at Lehigh at the time, so it wasn't that far of a drive. I have a lot of friends in New York City, so it was just the best of all worlds. And then, right, this plethora opened up of complexity of that time and the cultural left and what was going on, that I really felt hadn't been touched upon before. And even with that book, I felt skimmed somewhat the surface in terms of
Well, you know what, Prof?
focusing.
In an hour and a half, I'm recording with Catherine Benhamou, who wrote the book about It's All True.
Oh,
And
that's great.
when you look at what Wells and the Mercury Theatre and other people were doing, and obviously pod listeners will learn a lot more about this when they get the Michael Denning chat. It's an incredibly febrile time, and sometimes it gets overdetermined by a sense of loss and poverty induced by McCarthyism and the House Un-American Activities Committee, without looking at the real creativity, that was achieved, right?
Yeah, and how generative it was, outside the walls of Hollywood, and how that became a hub of intellectual and cultural activity in a profound way. Even the book, like, the first half of it's really of looking at the true, like, outside radicals. How can we maybe create a counter system even to Hollywood itself? In some ways, it's a, utopian project, but nonetheless, there was like sort of galvanizing hope that that might have happened. And I kind of pin it down after Eisenstein's failure in Hollywood and sort of Que Viva Mexico. There's more of an acceptance of, as well as sort of the rise of fascism, right? And this need to sort of unify among the left. There's a consolidation then to look in Hollywood, right? How can we focus within the studios itself and really start mobilizing within it? And it is such a rich period. Again, I feel there's so much more work that could be done within it, in the ways in which, writers, screenwriters, and directors, theater goers, and it's an international movement on top of it, right? So it's just such a fecund moment that you could see why, I'll just say, HUAC, right? Why it came later, why it might be fearful of this sort of, cultural block coming up. In some ways that, suddenly with Roosevelt dying, the end of World War II, so all these factors happened in that provide now the opening for reactionaries to finally attack. People forget that there were attacks in the late 30s, right? But they were totally failed. Like, they tried to accuse Shirley Temple of being a communist, the most beloved of all stars within the United States, And people think, I think it was this guy Martin Dies who did it from the Dies Committee, was out of his mind. So there was
Because
just no.
she turned out to be a Reaganite, right? Was a
Yeah.
Reaganite ambassador later in life. But one of the things that I guess is going on in that book, Left of Hollywood, Prof, is that you write about the male gaze a bit in advance of when people were talking that way, I would say. But you also, in addition to the gender issues, raise a lot of whoops, the podcat is on the prowl and trying to intervene. Be good, darling. But you also talk about race very significantly. There's a whole chapter in the book dedicated to it. And I wonder if you could, in terms of thinking about how we project ourselves into the past in a way, if you could talk about what it's like utilizing tools that really only emerged later, historically, to talk about the male gaze in classical Hollywood, but also tools that were, in a sense, available then and there, namely to talk about race. Could you
Yeah,
say a
I mean,
little
I'll
bit about
say,
that and those questions for the book?
yeah, for sure. Thank you for asking that. I will say that was fairly contentious, and I got a bit of pushback, right, about using the male gaze of bringing it back there. Now, granted, that right was a later term, though there were socialist feminists, right? That sort of was my grounding there, that were in many ways indicating, right, their critique of that what was going on. So I felt again there was something there, right? The socialist feminism was often underplayed, and the women who were, important female critics and directors were sort of being ignored at that time. So I was, in some ways, I always feel academia has a problem of trying to find the next new thing, and we haven't really flushed out the old things, right? So it's like, even Laura Mulvey was looking at older films, right, in terms of coming up with that term, the male gaze. So it both had applicability to me for close reading, right, the way in which these films worked, and sort of also an aporia on the left often in terms of looking at gender itself. And then the few critics who were attuned to a socialist feminist, type of read. And I wanted to give kind of shout outs to those people, right, who were doing that kind of work as well. In terms of race, and I thought it was just really important to bring these things in, of not creating kind of like idealized notions of the past. Yet another scholar, to say Anna Everett, did a book way back when on Black film criticism, and it really got me thinking at the time. And I think we just suddenly had an archive available, like a digital archive, into historic Black newspapers. And guess what? There's a plethora, right, of writing going on at that time. And I found it interesting in the way in which, Black critics are explicitly addressing race. Hollywood, in some ways, can't address it explicitly, given the sort of racial capitalism that operates within Hollywood itself, as Cedric Robinson has well pointed out, yet nonetheless using metaphors, right, that would indicate sort of race going on, as well as many of the people within Hollywood. If people remember, there were two failed anti-lynching bills that came up in the United States, in the Congress at that time, right? Because lynching was on the uprise. So it was very much in the public consciousness at this time in Hollywood, trying to sort of indirectly address, right, these racial issues, which are obviously problematic when you erase the actual bodies and people who are being the main targets of it itself. So it's a complicated dance going on. Part of it, too, is these films weren't seen, just in the theaters. People were writing about them and they had rallies. So in some ways it's interesting too how the criticism and the events would, right, bring back the repressed elements of race and the historical coordinates that Hollywood takes out to address that.
And one of the other elements related to this that you've already touched on en passant, Prof. C, is Eisenstein and Que Viva Mexico and so on. You've written about Eisenstein at least a couple of places that I'm familiar with. I think maybe in Jump Cut and perhaps Cineast, certainly Jump Cut. And I wonder, and for those outside the US, which is the majority of the audience, who may or may not know this, Jump Cut is something that's been going for 50 years and started out as a kind of massive broadsheet of a thing, and now I think is just online. But along with Cineast has been really the nub and the hub of radical film criticism in the United States. But tell us a little bit about your take on that epic failure, as it were, but also the question of Eisenstein in US radical cultural history.
Yeah, it's such an amazing moment, right? Where Eisenstein's starting to feel the heat of Stalinism brewing, right, in the Soviet Union, and the limitations that are starting to be imposed. So he has that invite, first of all, from Hollywood, out of all places, to go visit. I mean, he's such a complicated figure. I was just literally teaching Battleship Potemkin yesterday in my undergrad class, and how that film still resonates. I'll get back to the question you asked, but I'll just say this. This one moment of we're talking about it, I had a really smart student. So I focused on the scene where this guy, Valentichuk, they're having a funeral for him. He's a sailor who resists eating this rancid meat, right? That's
The
old
shot of the
maggot.
meat is horrendous. Yeah.
Brilliant, right? And so they're having this massive funeral and also rally around Valentichuk's body. And so I have one student ask, like, who are these people who are coming around, like, seeing, Valentichuk? How are they related to it? Like, Eisenstein's not letting us know this. And so I did my good moment where I'm like, well, does anybody want to answer that? Does anybody else in the class sort of want to answer? And this, of course, you have brilliant students, right? So another student goes, well, isn't that the point? We don't know, right? Like that they're, that they're strangers, but they're feeling impacted by the self, going on. And then I built off of that student's input and I go, well, like, how did this certain couple million people know who George Floyd was when he was murdered, right? Or Breonna Taylor when she was murdered, right? Why were people galvanizing upon that, right? And you could see sort of the light bulbs going off of this distant film, right, from 1925, and the structures of mourning and resistance and collective energy resonating in this present moment when you just transfer it there. So I'm just, Eisenstein, I just will say, is an amazing filmmaker that, if taught right, can really resonate with the present moment. Of students. And yeah, that Cave of Machiavelli film, going back to that, I mean, all the guardrails are off. That's sort of the most amazing thing. He does not have any kind of limitations. So he really wants to incorporate all of Mexico, right, into this. And perhaps the most, fabulous potential sequence was the female revolutionaries he wanted to focus on during the Mexican Revolution. And who knows what would have happened, right? Like, some of this was done, some of it wasn't. We do have the screenplay, or potential screenplay for it, that most of us use. And I went to the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, back in the day, to see all the rough cuts of it, however many hours, I think 8 or so, there on a moviola, which was just a pleasure of the we're seeing these strips of film that are not totally connected yet, the potentiality behind them, right? People were particularly juiced up with that project. Unfortunately, as the story goes, people who were bankrolling it got worried in terms of, the radicality of the film, how long it was going to be, and suddenly they send down a director to replace Eisenstein and corral this stuff, right? They take his footage away from him. It's a really sad story of, and this is often, to be honest, it marks the moment of Eisenstein onward where a lot of projects get taken away from him when he returns back to the Soviet Union, right? That we only have snippets of or intimations of what they could have been. Even October in 27, right, was reduced significantly to get rid of Trotsky out of it. So, and I don't think we have those sequences, as far as I know, what's going on. But in some way, Eisenstein, I felt, was, first of all, he was such an international figure, and so central for the avant-garde and commercial media. It's hard to even imagine a director of that stature and potentiality who seems to be able to work both within and against the system simultaneously. And I think many people were attracted to him. And when the failure of Cave of Mexico happened, it was pretty devastating, I think, for the more radical left, in terms of media making, of if he can't do it, right? If this most preeminent of directors, in many ways, can't do it, and they're pulling it out, that we need to reevaluate what's going on. And again, I don't want to overplay that. There's a bigger cultural moment of the rise of fascism and stuff, where we have to, like, start working with people who might not agree with, the socialists, the communists, right, the Christian Democrats, so on and so forth, to create a bloc again, so we don't become like Germany, essentially, that falls apart.
No, sure. And of course, popular fronts are good things in a myriad of ways. And of course, the other thing about this great man, I was thinking about him today, funnily enough, Chris. Near where I live, there's a bit of a hill, not huge, but something. And because Madrid is an old city, it's cobblestones. And occasionally people are pushing strollers, pushers with babies in them. And I keep seeing, you know what, sequence from the Odessa step.
Yes.
And I'm ready to run and save the baby. I'm not going to let this happen because it's lived with me, that sequence, since I saw it for the first time 50 years ago. That, and I guess the fetid meat, yeah, but most of all, the baby carriage and the smashed glass, smashed spectacles, so the chaos. But the other thing about him, of course, is that he left a wonderful residue of writing about film. Both criticism and theory, and his Hegelian dialectic notion of editing is fabulous. His stuff about Dickens and realism is amazing. So, moving away from all of that, I wanted to ask about what I think was your next book, I think, which is on anarchism and the media, and to talk a bit about that, because I've been trying to put together materials for my students about anarchism. And one of the things that happens in public school in Spain, evidently, I didn't know till I moved here, is that you're kept willfully ignorant of the Civil War and the opposition to the fascists and how splintered it was and complex it was, but the role of anarchists in defending the Republic and fighting the fascists. So I'm interested in that anarchistic tradition. And how to explain it to students. So I wondered if you could talk a bit about the book, but also getting it on the agenda for the classroom for you. Not just the book, but the issues that it engages.
Yeah, it's so complicated too, because there's so many anarchisms, right? That's the first thing you're always dealing with. Ever since I wrote that book, everybody's like, well, Robé is an anarchist, And I'm like, actually, I'm more, socialist and Marxist, but I'll defend them. I weirdly, find myself, defending and teasing out the thing, because I do feel this is blunt way of understanding anarchism as chaos and just anti-intellectual and just so ill-informed in so many ways that I became aware of as I was working on that book, that I'm much more sympathetic, right, to anarchists who are like tired of being talked about in that dimension. And part of what led that book, as Breaking the Spell that I did, I just felt like that dimension wasn't being talked about in terms of media act. So there was not a connective thread going between these various movements that would allow for a different type of trajectory in history to be detailed than had been so far. So, often when people talk about ACT UP media, in terms of AIDS activism and what was going on, it's disconnected from like what was going on with Paper Tiger TV or this or that, even though there were overlaps obviously going on, or the alter globalization movement. So in some ways, by honing in on both the people and the practices that were kind of anarchist inflected, either consensus-based decision making, non-hierarchical, or direct action, right? Making the change you want to see itself opened up a certain new history to me that was there all along. And some people obviously knew it itself, but it hadn't been really written about. So it was sort of an ambitious project to just create connective links to sort of like the end of sort of film, celluloid being one of the predominant modes of media resistance, right? In the late 60s and 70s. And I kind of document the limitations of that, both the Battle of Chile, right, with the rise of Pinochet and actually having to smuggle that stuff out to Cuba where it was completed and hadn't been seen back in Chile like decades later, right? Hadn't been seen for the intended audience to mobilize upon, as well as locally within the United States, this sort of mixed bag film finally got the news that came out of Detroit, produced by Detroit Newsreel and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, were totally overlooked. Social formation and resistance a movement that gets often effaced by the Black Panthers, which have their own right and important history, but in some ways, it's a really important moment. The League and the Revolutionary Union movements going on within Detroit at that time that are sort of calling out Price, the industries, and the UAW for sort of the racism. So yeah, and then it sort of chronicles all this sort of anarchism all the way up to the present. At least at that time, I went up to like 2011 with Occupy, which was really a game changer in terms of live streaming really becoming central. And I just couldn't tackle that in that book because it was already so big of what I wanted to do. So, I guess with students, it's really targeted, but also I do feel like I do anarchist practices in my class. So not just like explaining it to them, but I was doing peer review also yesterday. And it's kind of the point where they do their own reviews and I can leave the room actually. And I come back later, to let them have the space to themselves and have a sense of speaking. So, I try to do it on both levels, intellectual, but often when I am talking about anarchism, I try to incorporate certain practices within the classroom that show them they're already somewhat operating that way. Again, it would be false in some ways for me to claim this is an anarchist classroom. I'm grading them. I mean, there's all these power differentials obviously in there, but you can give them tastes here and there, I feel, of what's going on. And just troubling their notions that they might have of what it is. I will say I feel lucky in that I teach a class called Radical Film and Media Social Movement. So I didn't realize this when I designed the class, but it brings in the misfits, and I mean this in an affectionate way, right? The misfits and sort of the politically unwanted from the norm into the class. So in some ways they teach each other, like you will have students who are part of, anarchist movements. I'm a co-advisor with a friend of mine for the local anarchist student club here on campus. So in some ways, I feel like going back to what I was saying about Eisenhower, when you throw the floor open to other students and you have a diverse classroom, them speaking to each other, right, does a much more effective thing in terms of helping to understand, right, these complex ideas and multifarious movements, right, in so many different ways.
Oh, absolutely. And I really like the idea of, in a sense, giving away a little bit of power, or more appropriately, pointing out their role, their lives, their centrality in the classroom, and that this is a world that they are also helping to create and tend and sustain and potentially change. I think that's terrifically helpful, actually. And of course, breaking down this notion of a monistic account of what anarchism is, particularly given its faith in education, if done the right way, rather than this notion of it being a celebration of ignorance and somehow rather nihilistic. So I think that's really useful. Yeah. I'm trying to find ways of showing them what it is as a set of theories, different political movements, including anarcho-syndicalism, syndicalism. But also, what it means for a notion of the digital world. What is anarcho-digitalism, for example? And I'm sure it's here in Spain, I just haven't found it.
I'll
But
say this too, just in terms of, my classroom, because these kids often come from disadvantaged backgrounds. So I feel like they have been on the brunt of authoritarianism for like a long time in terms of,
right.
telling them they're stupid, that they have no ideas of their own, that they can't do this work itself. It feels like a lot of the work in my classroom is unlearning all that garbage. And in some ways, it speaks to them when you start giving them iotas that they do have a voice, that they do have a collective sense
Beautiful.
of identity. That again, so I think that peer review thing is really important of them just talking to each other and meeting each other and validating and critiquing in a way that there's not sort of a, I know I still am the central authority, but I'm trying to at least mediate myself out of it within this sort of given system itself. That there's something profound there, right, at its core, that at least experientially might need not need to be taught because they know what it means to be not listened to and dictated at, and you're right, and having their world totally planned out for them.
Now, this gets me to your newest book, which I must admit I haven't read, Abolishing Surveillance. Yeah? Could you share with us a little bit about that volume?
Yeah, it's sort of like part two off of Breaking the Spell. I'll say Breaking the Spell was my idea. I'm gonna go big or go home, regardless how good or bad it is. I really wanted an ambitious project. I was very influenced by David Graeber, and the work he was doing, and particularly a beautiful failure of a book, but I love it. The direct action that he wrote for AK Press a while ago that really put it in my mind of like not working through university presses and what potentially could be done, you know, there. And so anyway, state repression does come up somewhat within Breaking the Spell, but at the time I felt like people were using that as the main argument for like why these movements sort of fail. And they had their own kind of internal contradictions and some shouldn't be, you know, forever either. But nonetheless, I felt coming to the new book, I underplayed a bit. Right, state repression and sort of its multifarious ways. So I really wanted to pick four different movements that aren't often talked about in relationship to one another. And even when you interview people from the movements, don't really have a familiarity with each other. So I was hoping the book and talking about it and going around, like I'm trying to go around and tour with it in the places that I was at, so I can get feedback on it and where these movements are at, as well as, you know, fielding questions about other ones. I thought it was important to show how very different groups are dealing with similar issues, but they're differentially applied to them, right? And how they're nonetheless trying to pursue a sense of self-determination, right? Nonetheless, in spite of it. So I look at, you know, counter-summit protesters, and particularly the 2008 Republican National Convention, where the media, independent media, is very much targeted. And this is not the first case in the US, but one of the most prominent cases of labeling local activists as domestic terrorists itself, and sort of what that dealt with. And then looking at cop watchers, particularly groups in New York City, mostly Puerto Rican origins, of how that operated, and offering a more complex notion of cop watching, how it's usually a part of other community organizing. It's usually not a singular thing unto itself. It's often done with, you know, anti-gentrification campaigns. Right, pro self-determination campaigns, so on and so forth. So I wanted to give a much more textured notion of how cop watching works in relationship to the celebration of Puerto Rican culture, right? That's the other side of it, of like, let's highlight the poetry and the music and so on and so forth in relationship. Then animal rights, I wanted to focus on, and I talked to a lot of undercover investigators. I was going to go out and actually go on undercover investigations myself, but then COVID happened, and that sort of ended that idea. So I, but nonetheless, they couldn't do it. So I probably got a lot of good interviews with people who could not do that work that they were doing. But you know, in terms of the state repression that was trying to make filming animal cruelty illegal, not the animal cruelty itself, but actually going on the factory farms and filming it, right? These are all have been pushed back as violations of the First Amendment, but it doesn't stop certain agricultural centric states to keep reinvigorating the same bad laws in different iterations, right? To just tie up activists in litigation, right? And fear and bills. And the final one was focusing on the Minneapolis and the Muslim American community there, particularly Somali American, and the way in which this program in the US called Countering Violent Extremism, which actually developed off of British anti-Muslim sort of legislation, and developed really off of the legislation against Northern Ireland in the early 70s itself, right? This is sort of the origin of suspect communities, the way it was applied. So these bad ideas get kind of reinvigorated in different moments, depending on different suspect communities. And looking at Minneapolis and sort of the rich terrain there of both activism and media making going on, you have like very rich Muslim American youth resistance going on there. This is even just prior to Trump getting in office in 2016. You have Unicorn Riot, which is probably one of the most vibrant independent media platforms ever centrally located there, which I don't think I even knew in advance. So it was just a really rich terrain in the way in which people were working. And yeah, I hope people enjoy like hearing about those different ways in which those groups are working to resist the state repression and also advance, you know, a more equitable world.
Wow, it sounds like a great book. One of the things that I try to point out to people who don't know the United States from the inside, or idiot journalists who go there, go to DC for 18 months, and then pontificate about it for decades later, is that this is not a conservative country. This is a country with a massive, rich stream of radicalism that goes back forever. You know, to resistance by Native Americans, resistance by enslaved Africans, and some enslaved white people too, and resistance by folks, you know, over the borders. And that, you know, there are tens of millions of leftists, as broadly defined, broadly construed. And I think one of the key elements of your work is to make those points, because the idea that this is the best you can get out of this is blue dog Democrats, as it were, Clinton Democrats, Obama Democrats, is absurd, actually. It's true that it's a totally gerrymandered country electorally, but that doesn't
Definitely.
actually say anything about public opinion. So I really think that you're highlighting these forms of action is incredibly valuable, or some kind of corrective to this.
Yeah,
Miss,
if I could I add something in there too, Toby, just
please
in
do,
terms
yeah.
of a corrective also in terms of media studies, where I feel first of all, I wasn't studying media activism for the longest time. Then sort of 2008 happened, the Great Recession, and I do feel, and then 2011 happened, sort of really the Great Revolt across. And then this has interested younger people, right, in terms of studying these movements, which I'm thrilled about because I felt like in the hinterland, for a long time, me and a couple other scholars who do this, and the longtime scholars itself with, what's going on. But we also have a tendency in media studies to focus on what goes viral all the time, which I think is important and needed, right? Of the videos that do that and what's implicated and how is this, suffering of people being, killed by the police, right? Having an impact on diverse communities itself. But I feel like my work too is like focusing on the local in a way. Like it doesn't have to go viral. Matter of fact, it never has to be seen in some ways to have an impact in local communities itself. And we can't overlook those practices. So in the book, I do a sort of important moment in Minneapolis where one of the lead youth organizers, this guy named Burhan, was leading a thing against the project called Countering Violent Extremism that's been descended on Muslim American communities within the United States. So he's doing some panels against that. Lo and behold, who comes up to his front door? He doesn't open it smartly. It's two FBI agents. And he takes out his camera and films it, like literally at the door, but just getting a thing. And you hear sort of the badgering going on between the FBI and fishing expeditions, right? How can they turn people over to become informants for the FBI is essentially what's going on. Anyway, the video went viral like 2 months later, and I was like wondering what was up. So I finally met Burhan in Minneapolis, and I go, "What? So what happened? Like, it's a weird lag. Usually, right when you film something, it goes up." He goes, and this was such an important corrective to me, and I think just worth reminding. He goes, "Listen, I did not shoot that video to go viral. I shot that video to protect myself. So when
Yeah.
people saw the FBI coming to my door, I could play back that I was not a cooperative witness with them because I was worried about my own community." He goes, "Only when I was talking to an independent journalist and showed him this, he goes, 'What is this?'" And Burhan explains, like, this happens almost every day in Minneapolis. The journalist's like, "This has to go viral, right?" And it does 2 months later on Truth Out. But I think it's just a really indicative thing. First of all, for a media studies scholar, if you read it at a distance, you could just misrepresent it as he shot this to go viral itself instead of doing it for his own community and hopefully never having to be used. That was the goal, right? That nobody would see this, nobody would question him and kind of ruin his thing. And I think
In a
there's just
way,
access to that.
it's counter surveillance. He's filming an attempt to get him to engage in surveillance in order to use the footage as surveillance of his innocence to his own people.
Do you want to hear an interesting twist here, Toby, with the whole thing? So one of the FBI agents I think his name's Terry Aubrey, was one of the few black FBI agents in Minneapolis and had problems with the massive racism within the FBI. He ends up trying to report this and get thrown in prison himself for actually leaking documents for like, I forget how many years. So the worm keeps turning.
Grief. I'm sorry to hear that happen to him. And mentioning media studies' role in this, of course, in Rick Maxwell's Life of Herb Schiller or Intellectual Biography of Herb Schiller, he draws on FBI files obtained through Freedom of Information that show that within communications at the University of Illinois, when Herb was there before he went out to California, there was an informant who was naming him as an insurgent to the authorities in Champaign-Urbana, hotbed of red sedition. In any event, Prof, to conclude, I'd like to ask you one question, if I, or two questions, if I may, and then throw it to you to add anything you may wish. Does that sound okay as a means of concluding?
Sure.
So the first question is to ask you a little bit about something you've already disclosed to us, how you do your research. I can see lots of cardboard boxes up to your left at the top of the book. How do you find shit out, Prof?
That's a great question. That's a great question. I feel having a lot of social networks, right? And keeping your ear to the ground and going out and not being an extracted type of scholar where you just go out once and go back. Like people tell you, I learned so much from the people I'm researching and interviewing that sets off sort of ideas with that. There's also intuition, right? Like you kind of cast your net wide and interview a lot of people and see what ultimately starts kind of shaking out with it. And I felt that with Minneapolis. I was talking to a lot of Muslim American youth across the country, New York, DC, LA, so on and so forth. And just Minneapolis started feeling right in terms of a very rich area to do. So I feel like there's a lot of intuition and listening, right? Like listening what people are saying and not being hung up of like with your questions and where you want to go, but you want to like see where things. It's always hard for me to tell where I imagined the project originally and where it ends up because inevitably it changes so, dramatically as you learn and progress through this itself. I'll just say, even my stuff on sort of the conservative media activism came out. I can think of like a conversation in Montreal with some people who I interviewed, became friends with in 2016. We were just hanging out on a stoop, drinking some beer. And they're like, when are you gonna start writing about the right? Like everybody writes about the left. They started getting on me about it. And it kind of stuck. And they were telling, before I knew who Gavin McInnes was, right? Repulsive Proud Boy and one of the, not founders, but early into Vice magazine. And I just got an earful from a couple of people who were doing this activism that it just sunk there to me of like, okay, they got a point. Right? Like, we aren't really writing about this stuff. So, you never know where it's going to come from, right? I feel like that front stoop, right, in Montreal in 2016 was so fortuitous in some ways. And who knew Florida was going to go like, where it's at now that I found myself in the belly of the beast, but it's been percolating since then. So, I don't try to be too directive in some ways of like where I feel my research should be
Well,
going. But
I would say it sounds like being agile is the key element and operating inferentially, where you pick up on cues that are given to you by the kinds of social movements that you endorse, that you admire, that matter to you, and having the agenda in part set by them. So, my last question before throwing to you, Prof, is to put this to you. So, I'm a young person, 25, 23. I finished college. I really like your work. I've read it. I'm interested. I knock on your door a bit tentatively and I say, Prof C, Prof R, Prof CR, should I do a PhD studying the media? or should I be organizing? And if the answer is neither A nor B, can I combine them and do C, both of the above? What do
Oh
you
my
say?
God, that's a fun.
What do you
That's
say?
complicated. So you're ending with that one. I feel like almost the organizing is the easier side. The going into the PhD is just like I'm always wrestling with that, you know, given the political economy of the university and the challenges that are a part of there, where you want to make them aware of that, but not deter them, right? There is, I feel, a fire in the belly, if nothing less. It's sort of irrational at the core of what we do. Like, why do we want to write? Why do we want to do this? I don't have the answer exactly. And sort of that would perhaps be part of the conversation of just like getting a sense of where that student's at. Same with organizing, I imagine, right? In terms of listening again, right? Of where they're at and where you can rechannel, you know, where their energies need to be channeled most productively. Itself. I would never want to be somebody to deter somebody going to the academy if they're really like they just like seem to have the best of intentions for it. And I'm like, as opposed to where I feel I grew up working class, so I should just maybe say that's like, you know, that wasn't even my purview back in the day. Going to college wasn't even in my mind. So it's hard for me to even imagine where a majority of faculty often come from sort of like upper middle class backgrounds, and it's sort of assumed you should be slotted that way. I can't comprehend that totally. And at FAU, you're more likely going to get somebody like me, right? So we can have actually a much more common conversation. This is why I like working where I do, despite the monstrousness of your sponsor, DeSantis, and these other things. You can edit that out. The students are good, right? And I believe in the institution, and we're trying to do the best we can to maintain the integrity of what we're doing here, despite all of this of what's going on. So I think just listening to them, right, and hearing them out has been like really one of the most important things. And then respond, right? Not having sort of a preset thing, but really.
I think that's tremendously important in allowing their desire to express itself, what it is that's jazzing them, what's mattering to them. As you say, in many cases, people whose wishes have not been seriously addressed very often in their lives, despite the rhetoric of neoliberalism, despite the rhetoric of the university is there for you to make your future horseshit. It's there for you to obey and pay, right? So, Prof, are there things that we haven't touched on that you'd like to mention, or things that we have addressed that you'd like to say something more about?
I'm just trying to think. We mostly covered things. What, oh, can I ask you a question? Is that all right, Toby, in terms of what's
Look,
sort of motivating
if I
you?
could devote the entire episode to talking about me and my thoughts, I'd be incredibly happy. So go right ahead. Be my
So here
guest.
we go. Okay, we'll turn it back in terms of what is, you know, energizing you now or concerning you, or on your mind. I'm curious where you're coming from.
Sure. Well, at a personal level, I've not had an inverted commas proper, i.e., ongoing job for 5 years. And so I've been in five countries in that time. I go where I can get work, and I've been fortunate to get that work. But, I'm on my salary is 25 grand a year, and I have no work after August, and I'm here illegally, even though I have a public university job. So one thing is about me and how I can keep going, right, to be honest.
Yeah.
Beyond that, and obviously that's important, but it's impossible to keep thinking about that because it's boring and you just get bitter or demoralized, right? It's there all the time. But beyond that, and much more importantly, I guess my frustration that just as the Civil War never ended in the United States, so I can see the Civil War here never ended. There are still people alive who were tortured by the fascists during their 40 years in power, who bear the physical and emotional scars of that, who've gotten no satisfaction, and this relates to what continues to go on in Latin America. And the fact that there are so many young, affluent people who love this fascist history here. This really concerns me. What is going on in many parts of the world, particularly places like the Democratic Republic of Congo and Sudan, where the level of suffering and horror is so intense, but also, and where, the French and the British and the US are so complicit in so many ways, and the environmental crisis, plus, of course, the horrors of Gaza that encapsulate so much of what is going on, particularly in parts of Africa, in terms of the global North's ongoing project of destruction of various kinds of difference, depending on what the desires of the day are. So those things are worrying me. What's dynamizing me, and I'll finish now with this, don't worry, Prof, is this project that I've got emerging, I hope, called Inventing People, in which I'm trying to sort out the philosophical, legal, economic, cultural aspects of genetic intervention, the new so-called liberal eugenics, what it is to be a person, what it means if you want to try to create someone who will have a perfect rotator cuff and be a great baseball pitcher, someone who will have the right kinds of muscle twitching to be a great sprinter, someone who will be a Catholic and not a leftist. All these fantasies about constructing the perfect child, right, that are so powerful, and that we're seeing with the moral panics as well as the hyper excitement over artificial intelligence, but also genetic engineering. So those are the things that are preoccupying, dynamizing, and certainly retarding me. Being living somewhere without papers means that you do go around with a baseball cap on, dude, pulled down, right? And I've had a very fortunate professional life in many ways, but it's not fortunate now.
Right.
So those are the
Sorry
things.
to hear that. Yeah.
Well, thanks for your support, and thanks for your wonderful work, which, along with so many other people that I know and care for over the years, has been an inspiration for many of us and continues to be so. It's been great. So
Thank you.
thanks, Chris, and thanks for asking these kind questions in order to get my sad, sack, pathetic response.
I don't think it's sad. If anything, I'll say, Toby, too. It's like, one thing with my work, why I do it too, it does give you hope in weird ways. People are always like, oh, how you study this awful stuff of like state repression and here and there, but you also are always seeing the resistance of it, often in less visible ways. And I feel this in a very intimate way now in Florida going on, and sort of the way it's brought together people. In the classroom and among faculty and so on and so forth, despite the most draconian, awful legislation and intense, right? And creating anxiety. And I really, again, feel bad, particularly for students who are only here at a finite time and they have to deal with this awful thing. Nonetheless, they are resistant. They have their own things. They are not like, unlike what the right wing thinks, is that they're a bunch of sponges who just absorb what they have, coming at them. Actually, they're highly dynamized and thoughtful people, right? Who have their own ideas and can integrate that itself. And actually, if we ever like want to take it seriously, we take our students' energy and intelligence seriously as it is and dialogue with it, not indoctrinate it, which is what the right way is doing.
Beautifully put, and you're absolutely right. Those kernels of hope can be really significant for all of us. So, thank you very much, Chris Robet. It's been great chatting.
Thank you so much, Toby.